From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Friends, this program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit us at stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
It was a half century ago that those words reverberated across the hearts and minds of our nation, stirring many to a new level of resolve to work for equality for all Americans. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke those words at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., to the 250,000 civil rights activists and supporters gathered for the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom on August 18th, 1963. On this week's show, we will do our best to remember the momentous events of 50 years ago with guests who were active in the civil rights movement during the last years of Dr. King and in the tumultuous aftermath of his tragic assassination, and those who are working today to promote the full availability of Dr. King's dream to all Americans. You're going to hear from the Reverend William Barber, head of the NAACP in North Carolina, where the Moral Monday protests he organized are pushing back against an onslaught of attacks on citizens' rights. And you're also going to meet Rosa Nell Eaton, a 92-year-old North Carolinian who had to fight for her right to vote over 70 years ago, and now finds herself having to fight for that right all over again. I'll also talk to Alexis Carteron of the New York Civil Liberties Union, which has been at the forefront of the opposition to New York City's unconstitutional stop-and-frisk policing policy. But first,
the movement saved my life. I was a very bright 16-year-old kid wanting and needing to do something with my life. And the movement gave me a voice and a place to be.
For over 50 years, Ruby Nell Sales has devoted herself to working for racial justice in this country, starting with her participation in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Selma to Montgomery marches, and through decades of tireless work, she has devoted her life to the struggle for equality. Today, Ruby Sales is founder and director of the Spirit House Project, a national organization that brings diverse peoples together to work for racial, economic, and social justice, as well as for spiritual maturity. On this important anniversary, I am honored and pleased to welcome Ruby Sales to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Ms. Sales, do you remember what it meant to you and to your friends when Dr. King spoke to the 250,000 people gathered at the March on Washington?
Yes, it was a very important moment for my generation. It was the first time in our history that we had seen such a large gathering of people of all colors. Because don't forget, we grew up in the South and never did we see black and white people gathered together. So this was an eye-opening experience that it was possible for white people and black people to carve out a common ground for a common dream. And the whole sense of I have a dream represented a theology that undergirded black people for 300 years through enslavement and through segregation, and the ability to be prophetic and to dream in a world that reduced you to nothing.
Ms. Sales, talk a little about the experiences you had in Port Deposit, Alabama, and how that impacted the direction that your life took.
Actually, I grew up in Columbus, Georgia, Fort Benning, Georgia. My father was a chaplain in the Army. I grew up on the Army base. It was integrated. In Columbus, Georgia, it was deeply segregated. black and white people lived in very different worlds. And there had been incidents of violence and even a lynching or two in Columbus, Georgia. So while it was not the most repressive city in the South, it was the representation of the apartheid that hung over the South like a blanket.
Do you remember at what point you were really aware of the tremendous amount of prejudice against you just because of the color of your skin?
I was most aware of it when I rode the buses. I always had a deep rebellion in me about sitting on the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
So when my friend and I would go shopping, I am ashamed to admit it, but I would pretend that I was spastic as an excuse to sit in the first seat that I came to. And then when we would get to our stop, I would jump off the bus normally, and we would all fall out laughing. So I think my deep resistance was around the bus, the real understanding.
Huh. I mentioned Port Deposit because that is a place that has a special significance for you as well, because that's where the shooting took place that impacted your life in such a way. Would you tell our listeners about that experience?
Well, many African Americans in Fort Deposit were sharecroppers, and they were required to shop at the company store, and they would be cheated out of their yield, the profit from the yield. African-American young people in Fort Deposit got very tired and very resentful of the treatment that their sharecropping parents received. So they came to SNCC and wanted to organize a demonstration. And on the day of the demonstration, it was my first encounter with white violence. There were people there with shotguns, garbage pail tops, sticks, bats. And it got so out of control, we were taken to jail on a garbage truck. And when I say we, I say Stokely Carmichael, I say Jonathan Daniels, I say Father Richard Morris Rowe. We were put in jail for 7 days. I was very sick without food and water. And then out of nowhere, we were told that we were free to go. And we protested that. And we were run out of jail at the butt of a shotgun and told to get the hell out of the jail. And we were very hot, and we were thirsty. So the group selected Jonathan Daniels, Father Morris Rowe, Joyce Bill, a local African-American woman who had been in jail with us, and myself, to go to the corner cash grocery store where we had been many times to get sodas. And when we got to the door, this man whom I had never seen before, Tom Coleman, was standing in the door waving a shotgun and uttered profanities that start with a B, "I'll blow your brains out." Mm-hmm. And before I could process what he said, Johnson pulled me from behind and I fell on the ground. And the next thing I knew, Tom Coleman had shot Jonathan Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
And Father Morris Rowe was running with Joyce Bailey, protecting her. And the next thing I knew, Tom Coleman had shot him, and he was lying on the cement. Tom Coleman was found not guilty, and he never served a day for the murder of Jonathan Daniels and the mutilation of Father Richard Morris Rowe.
You know, I mean, it is just painful to hear you tell that story. How in the world, after watching that kind of thing happen, could you ever love this nation and want to work as you've worked in it?
Well, I love this nation because I am an American. I have no other nation to love. My father loved this nation enough to go and fight for it. My family, that generation of African Americans who raised their children, refused to teach us to hate. We were forbidden to hate. If we said we hated somebody, our parents would get very upset. So I came out of a theology of love. It never occurred to me to hate white people, but what it did occur to me was to contest their behavior. So I see this as my country, and I have a stake in making sure that the threads of democracy are strong.
Ms. Sales, as we remember the 1963 March on Washington and the role it played in the civil rights movement, it's important that we look at the parts of Dr. King's dream that have not yet been fulfilled. I know that you're doing some very specific work. You've been traveling the country documenting some very disturbing events. And I want to give you the opportunity to talk about that work, which is something probably most Americans don't even know about.
Yes, just as it happened after Black Reconstruction, where Blacks had enjoyed unprecedented political power, economic and social power, there was a rise of white supremacy, a reinsurgence of white supremacy held together by terrorism and violence. We see that trend developing today where across the nation, Black young people and some Black older people, men and women, are experiencing grave violence. For example, we went down to Lucedale, Mississippi, where Billy Joe Johnson, an African-American man, 17 years old, who had scholarships to most of the major universities because he was an outstanding athlete, was coming home one early morning. The deputy stopped him and went to check his license plate. And when the deputy came back, he said that Billy Joe Johnson had taken a shotgun and blown his brains out. Very suspicious death. The family was not allowed to see their son as he lay in the street for 7 hours. The only two people who were allowed to see this young man was the coach and the superintendent of school. And then he was sent away to Jackson, Mississippi for an autopsy, and his family were not allowed to even view his body until he came back home. And when he came back home, certain body parts below the belt were missing. And then there's Javis Carter, who was arrested in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was put in the police car, handcuffed, and chained. He was frisked. Later on, the police said that he had a concealed weapon and that he took out the weapon and blew his brains out. This is just two cases, but since Trayvon Martin's murder, there have been 29 people who've been killed, 29 African-American people. I've tabulated the deaths since 2001, and they are in the range of 40 to 50 deaths.
I know that you're going to be a part of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. What would have the greatest impact on a real change in the civil rights movement today that is more progressive?
Well, I think, first of all, to understand that the civil rights movement was more than about laws. It was about the dignity and the efficacy of Black people as being citizens and the children of God. And so to have a larger, expansive understanding of what that movement was about and how it freed both Black and white people from the burdens of segregation. And so what I would like people to remember is that first and foremost, the Southern Freedom Movement was a spiritual movement that gave each person an opportunity to transform their lives and to transform how they live in the world. And the other thing that I strongly call on the churches to move away from prosperity gospel to human rights gospel to a gospel where God is on the side of the poor, where God is on the side of people who fight for liberation. I believe that the church has a new role to play, and I hope it won't be silent as it was for 100 years during Southern apartheid.
Reuben L. Sales, thank you so much for being with us today on this significant anniversary. And I wish you strength and perseverance in your important work.
And the same to you. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to have voice in this great conversation. Godspeed.
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time.
Still to come on this week's show, the Reverend William Barber, head of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, and the plaintiff in that organization's lawsuit over that state's new restrictions on voting rights, Rosa Nell Eaton. I'm Welton Gaddy. Alexis Carterone is a senior staff attorney at the New York Civil Liberties Union, where she focuses on civil rights, civil liberties, and reproductive rights impact litigation. Ms. Catterone, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
The NYCLU has taken a leading role in analyzing and opposing the stop and frisk policy of the NYPD. And I think that first part is really important because this isn't just some kind of knee-jerk anti-law enforcement initiative. So I'd like for you to talk about the numbers that you compiled regarding how stop and frisk has been implemented in New York City in recent years.
You're quite right that this has not been a knee-jerk reaction. Everyone's in favor of law enforcement that's well done. And we've been really concerned that the NYPD has been violating people's rights without actually making a significant difference in our safety. So what we found is that the number of stop and frisks in New York City has increased by hundreds of thousands from the beginning of the Bloomberg administration to recent years. And it's been very clear that that's been happening without any clear evidence that it's making anyone safer. And instead, the NYPD has been violating many people's rights along the way. And that's why we've been very concerned about the stop and frisk policy.
How do you see these kinds of policies impacting individual members of the minority communities that bear the brunt of stop and frisk?
Well, the impact is really remarkable. We find that people who are subject to stop and frisk frequently don't trust the police. They don't want to work with the police. They don't even want to call the police when they're actually crime victims. And obviously that has a really detrimental effect on the police work that officers in the NYPD are able to do, and also is really bad for maintaining safety in our communities. So the erosion of trust is a huge problem. And, you know, it makes people, not only aside from the trust, it makes people not want to leave their homes. It makes people feel afraid to go about their daily business because if they walk down the street, they know it's possible that they're going to be stopped. And nobody should have to live like that.
Ms. Catterone, I know there are a lot of people are aware of Judge Shindlin's ruling earlier this month regarding the constitutionality of stop and frisk as currently practiced in New York City, and the angry response from Mayor Bloomberg and Police Chief Kelly. What's next in this case as you see it?
Well, there are a couple of things that are coming down the pike. First, with the cases that are pending before Judge Shindlin, she has appointed a monitor to oversee the implementation of reforms that will get the NYPD to stop the abuses and stop and frisk. So we're excited about moving forward and working with the monitor on implementing those remedies. Part of what he's also going to be doing is convening community forums so that the communities that are most affected by the problems with stop and frisk are able to have a voice in figuring out exactly what those reforms should be. The other thing that's next is implementation of the Community Safety Act. The City Council overrode Mayor Bloomberg's veto of two provisions that are really important for improving oversight of the NYPD. One creates an inspector general, which just about every other department in New York City has. So it's an independent inspector general who is able to make recommendations, review policies, and make recommendations for how to improve practices that are affecting many people across the city. And the other thing is that the council overrode Mayor Bloomberg's veto of a new ban on profiling in the city of New York, which is great news because it not only makes racial profiling illegal, it also creates other kinds of protections for certain groups, such as the LGBT community, homeless people, and a variety of groups, and gives that ban some teeth. So now groups will be able to go to court and secure relief against the NYPD if they're violating their rights in a systematic way. So we're really excited about these paths forward.
There are other jurisdictions where this practice is continuing. We've also just heard that Detroit is planning to implement stop and frisk, for example. So what are the big picture options for preventing racial profiling in police work?
That's a really good question. The NYCLU has never called for an end to the use of stop and frisk. Everyone thinks that stop and frisk is appropriate when the police actually have reasonable suspicion that somebody has or is about to engage in criminal activity. So we're not calling for the end of it. What we're calling for is the end of stopping people who have done nothing wrong. We're calling for the end of profiling. And I think it's really clear that there are a lot of police departments around the country that have done a lot of really good work. They've had drops in crime that are similar to New York's, and they've been able to do it without using stop and frisk in an abusive way. So we think that there are lots of models of places that are trying innovative things that doesn't require stop and frisk abuses.
I want to ask one last question about the stop and frisk app that the New York Civil Liberties Union is promoting. Would you talk about that and why that app is so very important?
Oh, we are really excited about our app, and there's been tremendous hunger for it, I think, in the community, because people really want to find a way to hold police officers accountable when they violate their rights. So, you know, the app, people can download it on their iPhones or their Android phones, and basically what happens is when you turn it on, it starts recording your encounter with the police, and then it sends the video straight to us. So it's been important for people to feel empowered, like they can do something if they feel like they're being disrespected or their rights are being violated. And it's just incredibly powerful for people to kind of take some control back in those situations.
Alexis Calderon is a senior staff attorney at the New York Civil Liberties Union, where she focuses on civil rights, civil liberties, and reproductive rights impact litigation. The organization was instrumental in gathering in-depth statistics on the implementation of the stop and frisk policy in New York City, and it brought one of the two lawsuits that led to Judge Shira Shindlin's finding on the practice being unconstitutional. Ms. Calderon, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I have a dream that one day, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. When Rosa Nell Eaton became one of the first African Americans in North Carolina to register to vote more than 70 years ago, she faced daunting hurdles like the Klan and Jim Crow literacy tests. Today, at age 92, she finds herself once more threatened by disenfranchisement. After the Supreme Court's ruling invalidating a key part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act opened the floodgates for restrictive voting rule changes by Republican legislatures, none more restrictive than those just enacted in North Carolina. With Ms. Eaton is the Reverend William Barber, head of the North Carolina NAACP. He's also the organizer of the headline-making Moral Monday protests in that state. Ms. Eaton, I'd like to start with you, if I could. Would you talk about what it was like for you registering to vote all those years ago?
Oh, it meant a lot to me. It meant that people in the world, the citizens, were improving and working together. It meant that our work was not in vain. It was a great progress and advancement for the people, for justice. And so I felt very good about the improvement of the nation, how we were working together.
May I ask you, Ms. Eaton,
yes,
in those days, were you an activist that was concerned about your rights then?
I began to get concerned when I was 10 years old. I got concerned about the nation, and as I grew into history and learned and read about history and learned about my grandfather being sold in Fayetteville, North Carolina as a slave, that's when I began to get interested. I was mostly out there alone, but I was concerned. And I think the Lord just put me here for that, because I didn't have people to work with me. I didn't have to ask anyone why. I went with my mother around, and my father was passed away when I was a child. And I learned from experience, just looking, why we were drinking this fountain and then the white people drinking that one, and why we didn't have bathrooms to go to. We had to come out of town and go, out.
Yes.
And the advantage was very, very slow.
Did you ever think that after going through all of that and then experiencing the civil rights movement, that you still would be fighting today for voter rights? Did that ever occur?
I didn't have any idea. I was disgusted. I was very upset because I went through all of that. Voting was something that we all, young or old, were equal on when we got it started and when we got the people registered. And I had no idea that we would go backwards instead of forward.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it.
Yes.
When I realized that we were going backward, it really, really upset me.
Well,
that's why I'm out here today at my age, because it's degrading. It's really something for people to be concerned about.
Reverend Barber, would you summarize the kind of changes in voting that Governor Pat McCrory has just signed into law in North Carolina?
Yes, it is what we call a monster bill. It is the most vulgar political expression regarding voting that we have seen in decades. This bill, while they try to say it's about integrity and voter ID, in fact, first, it ends same-day registration and early voting, which has benefited everybody, people of all different backgrounds. And African Americans, 34% of those use same-day registration. It rolls back early voting. When we should be opening up voting, they're trying to roll it back. 70% of African Americans, for instance, use that. It curtails parts of Sunday voting. It passes a voter ID bill with no evidence of voter fraud at all. After studying millions, over 18 million votes, the bill is worse than Alabama. It doesn't allow college students with student IDs issued by the state to be used, and it doesn't allow for incidences out of our control, for instance, hurricanes or other natural disasters where persons might lose or misplace their ID. They end public financing in significant places. They end straight party ticket voting. They are engaged in a process that says if you vote out of precinct, they will not count, as we have always done in North Carolina, the parts of your ballot that have nothing to do with precinct or a particular district. This bill continues to do a devastation to people's right to vote in North Carolina. We call it a fundamental crime against democracy, and that's why Ms. Eaton is one of our plaintiffs in our lawsuit, and that's why we're fighting it.
Why is the government of North Carolina doing this?
In my lifetime, we didn't have protected voting rights. I was born August 30th, 1963, 2 days after the March on Washington. So in 63, my father had 2 degrees, a Bachelor of Divinity, a Master of Social Work. My mother was trained, and they didn't have protected voting rights in the South. And all of that was designed, as you know, to hold on to the South. The way Reconstruction was ended in this country was by first denying voting rights. And the way we brought an end to the civil rights movement not only was through assassination, but there was a crucifixion of voting rights, attempt to tear them down, an attempt to create something called the White Southern Strategy in 68 that would control the South forever. Well, the new demographics are the great fear of those who have a homogeneous view of the world, who want only one group of people. Because now 23% of that electorate in North Carolina is black and 3% Latino. That means you only need about 23% of whites to vote their future, not their fears. The same is true in Mississippi, Georgia. So the South is changing. A new demographic is electorate. And the electorate that elected President Obama is a brand new electorate, and it's breaking through all of the solid South, the one party rule, the ultra-conservatism, and the only way to stop it is to suppress the right to vote. So they want to suppress the rights of African Americans, which is a form of racism, but they also want to suppress the right of students. They want to suppress the right of elderly people, because what they want is a small amount of people voting in order to control the government. Because whenever there's a broad electorate and everybody votes, narrow-minded, regressive, extreme political ideologies do not fare well at the polling place. Mm.
They don't believe in democracy, obviously.
Well, obviously. Right now, we have three colleges under attack. Appalachian State, mm-hmm. they're trying to remove the polling places. At Winston-Salem State, they're talking about the same thing. Elizabeth City State, the Board of Elections Chair, Pete Gilbert, is trying to purge students from the voting roll, even though the Supreme Court case in 1979 said that students registering where they go to school is legal. And when we went down to quote to them the Constitution and to quote to them why this is a constitutional and a moral issue and it's a democratic issue, and we said that it seems as though an anti-democratic cancer is trying to spread across North Carolina, and we intend to cut it out with the scalpel of the Constitution and our moral protest. The chair of the Board of Elections suggested in an article that me standing up with those students could be misperceived and it might cause somebody to retaliate against me violently. In essence, he basically suggested that if you don't shut up, somebody's going to deal with you violently.
Goodness.
And so, yes, racism is deeply a part of America, of the South. There are people who live in the nightmare of regression. They want to, you know, deny people the right. The extremists, they want to deny people the right. So 50 years after the March on Washington, 50 years after the death of Mega Evers, we're having to fight not only to go forward, we're having to fight to hold on to the things that Ms. Eaton and others fought that we might have in the first place.
That's why you have filed the lawsuit on behalf of Ms. Eaton. Is that correct?
Yes, because the day that the Supreme Court took away Section 4, and I believe cowardly did it because they really wanted to remove the entire Voting Rights Act, but they said, we'll give you the car, we'll take the keys and the motor, which is Section 4. Senator Apodaca in our General Assembly went in the media and said, now that the headache has been removed, he described the removal of the Voting Rights Act as a headache, the very law that Mega Evers was shot through the heart in order for us to have. Viola Lewis, a white woman, was shot with a shotgun. Swain Achani and Goodman were killed. Martin would later be killed, shot through the neck because he stood up for voting rights. This senator said the headache has been removed. In essence, now we can do what we want to do.
Goodness.
And that's when they rolled out this omnibus monster bill. We filed a lawsuit because these individuals act as though, because Section 4 is in limbo, that there's no longer the 15th Amendment of the Constitution. But the 15th Amendment is still there. You cannot deny a bridge the right to vote.
Exactly right.
They act as though the 24th Amendment is no longer the law of the land, which says you cannot charge a poll tax. They act as though Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is no longer enforced, but in fact it is. And so we intend to rigorously, in this moment, defend the principles of the Constitution for Ms. Eaton and for everybody that would be negatively affected.
Ms. Eaton, you have been arrested for participating in the Moral Monday protests, and now there's this lawsuit. Why is it important for you to take on this kind of stress and worry at this point in your life? Most of us would understand if you said, I've done my work, let someone else do this. What's making you do this now?
Do all I can while I'm here. Well, my mind just told me to work until the day is done, not just stop because I've done so much. And that's true what you said about people saying that I've done mine, let them do theirs. But I've never thought like that. I think you should work as long as you are mentally able and health-wise and whatever. I think you should continue work if you can because it's out here. I mean, it's now prevalent than ever. And I realized it was going to start in 2010. I was still working. I never stopped, and I don't intend to stop.
Ms. Eaton, I am so glad you said that. Reverend Barber and Rosanelle Eaton, you have our blessings. We pray God's blessings on you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so very much for having us.
God bless you, and bless forward you. Together, not one step back.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show, friends. And what a show it's been. To think back to 1963 and think of myself in West Tennessee, surrounded by prejudice and watching Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on a black and white television set filled with more snow than clarity. I felt the challenge then. I have felt through the years progress in the fulfillment of Dr. King's dream. But listening to our guest today and reading the paper and listening to the news, I'm well aware that we have a terribly big challenge now. And we can't ignore what's going on around us now any more than Dr. King could ignore what was going on around him in 1963. At the very least, let's conclude, we have a lot of work to do. And it has to do with justice, and it has to do with democracy. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast. I hope you'll stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's always contact information available at stateofbelief.com. We encourage you to tell others about the show, bring them into the conversation we're having, and please join us again next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.